I am now recording.
Sorry, I did not hear that.
So, we looked at the Describe the Earth or Land Beast. He's the guy there on the far right. And he has the horns like a lamb, which that really doesn't have lamb's horn. Little tiny horns. Looks innocent, but speaks like the dragon. So it's a dragon in sheep's clothing. And we just started question five, what's the work of the land beast? And specifically trying to lure spiritual Israel back to Judaism and submission to Rome, which would then be worshiping the first beast or the sea beast. And we talked about how powerful and influential this false prophet is, the land beast, as the entire books of Galatians and Hebrews was written to try to fight against that influence. And I want you to understand that Judaism and the worship that the Jews were involved in and the practice of their religion at the time of Christ was not the religion that God had revealed through Moses. It was not the religion that Moses had practiced and commanded. Judaism denied that Jesus was the Christ. It denied Jesus because, in fact, it denied Moses. And I need somebody to again read for me John chapter 5. We just read this right at the end of class. I want to put that back in your minds again. John chapter 5, verses 45 through 47. Okay, Tim.
But do not think I will accuse you before the Father. Your accuser is Moses, on whom your hopes are set. If you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me. But since you do not believe what he wrote, how are you going to believe what I say?
Okay, so he just lays it out there. You don't even believe Moses. And so obviously you're not going to believe me. And if this land beast is speaking with the voice of the dragon, we know that the only thing it can speak are lies, because the dragon is Satan and his native tongue is lies. And so the land beast is working hand in hand with the sea beast, which is the Roman Empire in general. And he does so with the Roman Empire's authority and with his presence. And Judaism and her leaders are doing everything that they can to destroy the church. And the proof of that is in the inspired history of the book that we just started, which is the book of Acts. So if you open up to Acts, we're just going to really peruse through some passages real quickly here, just to give you a sense of that. In chapter 4 of Acts, starting at verse 24, this is after the apostles have been released, and they raise their voices together in prayer to God. Sovereign Lord, you made the heaven and the earth and the sea and everything in them. You spoke by the Holy Spirit through the mouth of your servant, our father David. Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? So the nations and the Jewish people. The kings of the earth take their stand against the rulers to gather together against the Lord and against his anointed one. Indeed, Herod and Pontius Pilate met together with the Gentiles and the people of Israel in this city to conspire against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed. They did what your power and will had decided beforehand would happen. Skip over to the 12th chapter of Acts. Acts chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. It was about this time that King Herod arrested some who belonged to the church, intending to persecute them. He had James, the brother of John, put to death with the sword. When he saw that it pleased who? When it pleased the Jews, then he proceeded to seize Peter as well. Chapter 13 and verse 8. 13 and verse 8. I'll find it here. But Elymas the sorcerer, for that was what his name means, opposed them and tried to turn the proconsul from the faith. Elymas was a Jew. Chapter 14 and verse 5. There was a plot afoot among the Gentiles and the Jews together with their leaders to mistreat them and stone them. Chapter 17 and verses 5 through 8. But the Jews were jealous, so they rounded up some bad characters from the marketplace, formed a mob, and started a riot in the city. They rushed to Jason's house in search of Paul and Silas in order to bring them out of the crowd. But when they did not find them, they dragged Jason and some other brothers before the city officials, shouting, "These men who have caused trouble all over the world have now come here And Jason has welcomed them into his house. They are all defying Caesar's decrees, saying there's another king, one called Jesus. When they heard this, the crowd and the city officials were thrown into a turmoil. Chapter 18 and verse 12. While Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews made a united attack on Paul and brought him into the court. Continuing reading, this man they charged as persuading the people to worship God in ways contrary to the law. Chapter 21 and verse 11. Coming over to us, he took Paul's belt, tied his own hands and feet with it, and said, "The Holy Spirit says in this way the Jews of Jerusalem will bind the owner of this belt and will hand him over to the Gentiles." Chapter 24, verses 1 through 9 is the trial before Felix, and you have the Jews accusing Paul there. Chapter 25, verses 2 and 3, the chief priests and the Jewish leaders appeared before him and presented charges against Paul. Down in verse 9, Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favor, said to Paul, "Are you willing to go to Jerusalem to stand trial?" Another passage, chapter in verse 24 of the same chapter. What I'm trying to show you here, it's not hard to see the efforts of the false prophet of Judaism trying to do everything it can to destroy Christianity and the church and spread of the gospel. A true prophet, like Samuel, stands in the presence of God. This one is standing in the presence of the sea beast of Rome. He is his mouthpiece. He is moving the agenda of Rome forward. And the leadership of Israel fits this picture very well, actually leading them to worship a counterfeit son, because the Caesars claim to be a son of God, who supposedly had experienced a counterfeit resurrection that we're going to read about three times in this chapter. And giving that as the basis for worship. Who can, as we read last week, who can stand before this this beast in verse 4? Who is like the beast? Who can make war against him? Now, as we continue on here, we saw that he makes, all of a sudden I lost my place. I'm sorry. Let me go back and see where I wanted to go from that point forward. Verses 12 through 14 is where I'm sitting. Verse 13, "And he performed great and miraculous signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven to earth in full view of men. Because of the signs he was given power to do on behalf of the first beast, he deceived the inhabitants of the earth or of the land and ordered them to set up an image of the beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived." And so this land beast, the false prophet, is performing great signs. And he is, in fact, a false Elijah. Elijah was the one who called down fire on the priests of Baal in 1 Kings. And they could not, the prophets of Baal could not do that. But this particular false prophet is able in some way to do that. Jesus warned them about that. Yes, Tim?
Read through all those in Acts, if only there had been more Gamaliel. You know, he was able to persuade them for a time, saying, "Well, let's just stop and see, you know, and if they're not true, then it'll just go away."
Right.
Well, it was true, and it kept going, but they...
Right. They didn't listen to that. If you go over to Matthew chapter 24 and verse 24, Jesus... said at that time, "If anyone says to you, 'Look, here is the Christ,' or 'There he is,' do not believe it." That's verse 23. "For false Christs and false prophets will appear and perform great signs and miracles to deceive even the elect, if that were possible." Who's the elect? The elect are saints. And so they're, again, trying to get them back. Moses, I'll go all the way back to Deuteronomy chapter 13. And verses 1 through 3, Moses warned about that as well. "If a prophet or one who foretells by dreams appears among you and announces to you a miraculous sign or wonder, and if the sign or wonder of which he has spoken takes place, and he says, 'Let us follow other gods,' gods we have not known, and let us worship them. You must not listen to the words of that prophet or dreamer. The Lord your God is testing you to find out whether you love him with all your heart and with all your soul. And so there were false signs. God allowed them in testing them to see if they were going to believe the truth or not. And you see them working in the book of Acts. In Acts chapter 8, you have Simon the sorcerer, who was a Jew. In chapter 13, we just read about Elymas, who was a Jew. In Acts chapter 19, we have Jewish exorcists walking around casting out demons and claiming to do so in the name of Jesus. And they appear to be exercising God's authority, and yet in the process of doing that, they show themselves to be opposed to Christ and to his church. And so that should be an indication. They're not accepting what God has said. And he who deceives, though, this person is deceiving those who dwell on the land. He in verse 14, he deceives the inhabitants of the earth. He's deceiving the Jews, the Jewish nation in apostasy, the Jewish nation who is rejecting the promised Christ, the promised prophet. And some have argued, and listen, I have made this statement myself. I can recall making it more than once, especially when we were going through the divided kingdom and the exile in Ezra, that the Jews were never guilty of idolatry after the exile. After they went to Babylon, when they came back, they didn't commit idolatry anymore. Well, listen, it's not necessary for you to erect a Baal or an Ashtaroth or some statue for you to commit idolatry. And I came across this definition of idolatry by a guy named Schlossberg. I don't know him from Adam, but I liked what he said. He said, idolatry in its larger meaning is properly understood as any substitution of what is created for the creator. People may worship nature, power, money, mankind, history, or social and political systems instead of God who created them all. We already saw that they have chosen Caesar over Christ. We have one king, and they are now worshiping and serving him, the creature, rather than the creator. And in fact, later, if you go back to, somebody turn back over to Acts chapter 20 and read verse 19. And I'll give somebody else another passage, 1 Corinthians 15, 32. And then Titus 1, 14 and 16. So, Mike, do you have Acts 20 and 19? And this is Paul speaking to the Ephesian elders in Miletus, and what does he say to them?
Serving the Lord with all humility and with tears, and with trials which came upon me through the plots of the Jews.
Okay, so he told that while he was in Ephesus, that he was suffering constantly through the plots, not of the Romans, but of the Jews. Now, in 1 Corinthians 15, 32, Ross?
If from human motives I fought with wild beasts at Ephesus, what does it profit me? If the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die.
Okay, and so what does he call the Jews that he fought against in Ephesus?
Wild beasts.
Beasts. Have you made that connection before? As we see it right here in Revelation? And then who has Titus 1? 14, okay, Megan, and then verse 16.
And will pay no attention to Jewish myths or to the commands of those who reject the truth. Verse 16. They claim to know God, but by their actions they deny him. They are detestable, disobedient, and unfit for doing anything good.
Okay, again, the Judaizers. They are the ones who are fomenting and pushing and striving against all that the gospel was intended to do. And this false teacher, false prophet, as you, I don't know if you can see it up there, especially if you're in the very back, but on the foreheads of every one of those people, I think I've got a pointer all across here, and then on the back of this person's hand, who's the only hand, and it's the right hand, we see the number 666 printed. And that's what we're reading here. He caused all of them to take on the number of the beast. And that's in verse 16. And For the Jews, the forcing of that was seen in the expulsion from the synagogue. Listen, if you weren't a part of the synagogue, you didn't do business. You couldn't buy. You couldn't buy what you needed. You couldn't sell what you wanted. Right now I'm reading a book. I think The Mountain They Faced is what it's called. And it's written about the Japanese internments that took place in this country at the beginning of World War II, and the removal of Japanese people from their homes, their farms, their businesses, and putting them in the desert somewhere in California or other places. And even before that, they were boycotted. People would not do business with them. They had bills just like everybody else, and they couldn't pay them. And that's when I was listening to that, I was thinking, that's exactly what's happening to Christians here who happen to be Jewish Christians. And when they are accepting Christ, they're thrown out of the synagogue and kept out of there. And who is left out of this description, as you look at verse 16, who's left out of the description of those who worship the beast? There's six different categories of people that are mentioned here, which I think is ominous that there's six of those categories. But he talks about, he forced everyone, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on his right hand or on his forehead. And so it's everybody. There's not anybody among the Jews who was not feeling that pressure. So any questions or comments on question five up to this point? Okay, your question six says, what does the mark and the placement of the mark represent? Anybody want to take a stab at that? Okay, Henry?
I think represents the beast tattoo, or the brand of his name, or numerical equivalent.
Okay. Well, if you go back to chapter 3 of Revelation in verse 12, let me give you what the opposite of it is. In Revelation 3 and verse 12, it says, him who overcomes, I will make a pillar in the temple of my God. Never again will he leave it. I will write my name. I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem. And so there's one aspect of it. In chapter 7 of Revelation, in verse 2, then I saw an angel coming up from the east, having the seal of the living God. He called out in a loud voice to the four angels who had been given power to harm the land and the sea, do not harm the land or the sea or the trees until we put a seal on the foreheads of the servants of our God. And then chapter 14 and verse 1, which is in the next chapter that we're going to look at. Then I looked, and there before me was the Lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000 who had his name and his Father's name written on their foreheads. So whatever the mark of this beast is, it's on the forehead and the hand, is the opposite of having God's name written on your forehead. Yes?
One thought that I have for kind of what it represents is why, like, it's on their right hand, is that if it is representing, you know, like, the beast's name, or just kind of, like, the beast itself, the dragon, if people, like, swear or raise, like, by their right hand, like, pledging or whatever,
okay.
So it's kind of like this, like, oath, servitude, you know, like they're pledging themselves to the beast, to Satan, by having that mark on their right hand.
Okay.
Kind of proclaiming it to everyone.
Right, and keep in mind that the mark of the beast is not the dragon. It's the mark of the beast, which is the sea beast, which in this case is Rome. So let me preface this. These none of this is literal. Okay? It's not your social security number, which I recall when I was in the 70s being told, the mark of the beast, you know, don't get it, it's a social security number. Or more recently, in like the last few months, it's the COVID vaccine. If you get the COVID vaccine and it's got numbers in it, you know, and they've got markers in it, and so it shows you that you've got the beast in you. I won't even honor that by giving it a really bad word. as far as my judgment of it. This has nothing to do with us today, first of all. This shortly to come to pass. Yes, Tammy?
Isn't it interesting that religions focus on the mark of the beast, and yet we see the mark of God, the seal of God, talked about so many times through there, and nobody talks about that.
Right.
It's all about
right.
not having the mark of the beast.
Right. That's exactly right. So somebody turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 6. And I need verses 6 through 8 read, and the key verse in this context is going to be verse 8. So Deuteronomy 6, 6 through 8. Okay, Paul.
And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk to them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as spotlets between your eyes.
Okay. So in that particular case, we've got the word of God, and we've got it on our hand, and we've got it on our forehead, between our eyes. And basically what it's talking about is full allegiance to God in everything that I think and everything that I do. Okay, so that's what that was about. And so to receive the mark of the beast here is in essence saying that everything that my right hand is, which is the power of actions, and the foreheads is where our hearts and thoughts are, that these are given to the beast. They're given in allegiance to the beast. And again, choosing salvation at the hand of Rome, trusting in Rome, as we just saw in verse 5 or 4, instead of trusting in salvation from God and in Christ. And as he goes on to say here, so in verse 17, so that no one could buy or sell unless he had the mark, which is in the name of the beast or the number of his name. So if you were a Jew and you were excommunicated from the synagogue, you were not allowed to have any economic intercourse with other Jews. Well, if you're a practicing Jew, could you have economic intercourse with Gentiles? Wouldn't that be an unclean thing? I mean, I remember Robin and I were just reading when the Jews were charging Jesus, and they wouldn't go into Pilate's palace because they didn't want to become unclean for the Passover while they're fomenting murder of the Son of God and using lies to get him accused. The Jews organized economic boycotts. In fact, you could be killed as a result of the end of verse 15, who refused to worship the image to be killed. Listen, the same thing was happening among the guilds of the Gentiles. If you did not worship Caesar, if you didn't take your little bit of incense and throw it on the altar of Caesar, then you're out of the guild and you couldn't work, you couldn't get a job. And the Jews supported that as well. In fact, go over to Acts chapter 19. You know what happens when you try to walk on both sides of a fence at the same time? It's bad, okay? And that's what you see happening here. You have this riot in Ephesus. Paul has been preaching that Diana or Artemis is not a real god, it's just a piece of rock, you know. And so the silversmiths are having a big to-do about that, and they create a riot. Now notice in let me find my passage here, verse 33. Let's go back to verse 32. The assembly was in confusion. Some were shouting one thing, some another. Most of the people did not even know why they were there. The Jews pushed Alexander to the front, and some of the crowd shouted instructions to him, and he motioned for silence in order to make a defense before the people. In other words, it's not us. It's not us. It's those Christians. It's not us. But then we read, it says, but when they realized he was a Jew, they all shouted in unison for about 2 hours, great is Artemis of the Ephesians. Would the Jews have accepted Artemis as being a god? No, but they weren't talking about it. They want to do business. And so they were trying to disassociate themselves from the Christians and coddle up to the Gentiles here, and it didn't work for them. So there's some interesting parallels here on this slide. You have the divine order. Let me look at, let me do this. The divine order is you have the Father, then you have the Son, who's in the image of God. Then you have the angels, which we read about in chapters 2 and 3, which would be the elderships. I have bishops, so you know, I guess you'd say bishoprics. And then you have the church, who's in the image of Christ. And the satanic parody of that is you have the dragon, who's Satan. You have the beast, the sea beast, who's in the image of the dragon. You have the false prophet, you know, the religious part of that, which is Judaism. And then you have the synagogue of Satan, which is in the image of the beast. And so that parallel situation exists as we're looking here at the end of verse 17. So that the one could not buy or sell unless he had the mark. Again, the bland beast, the false prophet, is the one who's pushing this forward. All right, so then in verse 18, which is probably where we're going to spend the rest of our time tonight, it says, this calls for wisdom. If anyone has insight, let him calculate the number of the beast, for it is man's number. How many of your translations say a man's number? Just take your little pens and just black out the because there is no indefinite article in the Greek. It's not a man's number, it's man's number. Okay, so it's man's number. In doing that, you're just making it more accurate, I promise you. You're not, not like the woman who said, you know, I don't have James in my Bible, because she didn't like what it taught. And it says his number is 666, not 666, but 666. Now, I gave you a handout here of the gematria, the Greek gematria. And you will probably also on that have the Hebrew gematria, which is simply the association of letters and numbers. We use, is it Arabic? The numeral system that we have is the Arabic number. So, pardon me?
Correct, Arabic.
So we have separate symbols for our numbers. The ancient languages didn't do that. They used their alphabets for their numbers. And so you have alpha number 1, beta 2, gamma 3, so forth and so on. And in fact, you have some as we go along there, like stigma, which is 6, which is an obsolete number. It's not in the Greek alphabet any longer. And then you have Sampi at the end, which I've never heard of before. Omega is usually the last one. So it's obsolete as well. And probably was by that time, that stood for 900. I just wanted to give you that to show the breakdown of the letters and numbers of value in Hebrew and in Greek. Let's see if I have the... Can you go to the next one, Sam? And then if it's not right, I'll have you go back. Actually, I can look at the next one on here. Yeah, don't go to it. Don't go to it yet. So, but on your sheets, you have the Hebrew Aleph, et cetera, with those numbers as well. So the number of the beast is man's number. Now, let me back up. Here's wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast. So that indicates that this riddle that he's giving to us can be known. If you have, it calls for wisdom. If anyone has insight, let him calculate the number. And listen, the readers of this time could figure it out. When they saw names, they saw numbers too. I mean, it was just natural for them to see that. My understanding that I'm about to give you may not be the exact answer, but it's plausible, and that's just what I want to give you. So as I said, the number of the beast is man's number, not a man's number, but so because there's no definite article. The sea beast represents all of the empires. We talked about that as well, and at this time it's the Roman Empire. And it's too big to be filled in just one person. But there can be a person who represents that entirety. We have a house that represents the entire presidency. We call it the White House. And it stands for all of the president and the office of the presidency. And so the original readers obviously would have recognized this as Rome. They would have understood that that's what Daniel said in his prophecy in Daniel 2, as well as perhaps Daniel 7. And now Nero is on the throne. And as we're looking at this beast that we've seen here, He's the embodiment of that, and we pointed that out a couple of weeks ago, yes.
We also need to tie in the last part of 17, verse 17.
Yeah, which is the name of the beast or the number of his name, right? And the beast is Rome. So it's also the number of man. And I'll explain a little bit more about that in just a moment. So what do we see here? Your question seven is, what is the number of the beast? And I said, please spell it out using words. Because I didn't want you just to put 666. I wanted you to write out, and if you did this, then give yourself full credit on this answer, 666. I wanted you to write out the words there. And I don't know why translators just translate it 666. So go to the next slide, Sam. So these are the three Greek letters, chi, xi, and stigma, that are written out. And as John is writing this manuscript out, he's writing those three letters. And as they would be reading those three letters, they would be reading, just like if I put LXI, what would you think?
61.
Yes. Okay, you would say 61. You wouldn't say, 61. No, you would say 61. And so that's what they would see here. And again, I'll tell you that last one, stigma, is an obsolete thing. Now go to the next slide, Sam. On this list of, as they're divided up into their groups, and you have this on your charts as well, but see how they go right across each other? Stigma, xi, and he. We say chi, but the ancient Greeks called it he, H-E-E. That they're all there. And what's below all of them? This number, and this number, and this number. It's just short of seven. And seven in numerology is complete. It's perfect. It's all things. And so here is just short of that. Didn't quite make it to that. And so you can see that they all line up that way. So question eight then is, who is represented by this number? And when you total the number of Nero's name, when it's written out in Hebrew, because we're speaking to Jews here for the most part, his name in Hebrew is Neron Kaiser. There's no vowels in Hebrew. So there's those seven letters in his name. And on your charts, you have those letters there. Nun, Reich, Vav, and Nun. And then Kuf, Samech, and Rash. And when you add those all up to Neron Kaiser, or Caesar, you calculate his number, you add the values up, it comes to 666. Now look at if you have in your Bible, by your number 666, do you have a footnote? And what does it say on your footnote? Some manuscripts have 616. And the 616 is a textual variant that is found in some manuscripts. And if you drop the last Nun from Neron to the more common way that he's known, which is Nero Caesar, then you take off 50 points off of the 666, if it's points or numbers, and you come up with a 616. Now, let me tell you, there's probably 7,500 names out there that you could make add up to 666. Do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, that's kind of half. When you say manuscripts, those are brief manuscripts, pre-translation,
yes.
Drop the number down to
yes.
16.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. It's, and they can work those back to see where that change was made.
Yeah.
And somewhere along the line, a scribe said, no, it's Nero. That was somebody added an extra letter in there that they took it out. Just in good kindly copying for it. I'm going to talk about that some more Sunday in my lesson this week. So though this is the main meaning, there's a deeper reference here. The number six itself was long held to be the number of man and the number of beast. Because when were they created? They were created on the sixth day. And 6 days were given for man and beast to work, and the seventh day was a rest. There were 6 cities of refuge for you to flee to if you were innocently or wrongfully charged, that you could get away from. Hebrew slaves, if you had a slave that was a Hebrew, he worked for you for 6 years. The seventh year he went free. And these are all parts of the law and the way that it works out. 6 also falls short of 7, the perfect number or wholeness. Creation was completed in 7 days. A week is 7 days. A full week is 7 days. And there were 7 months in the festival year of the Jews. All the Jews' festivals took place in a seven-month period. You can also see the number 6 in the enemies of God in the Bible. Goliath was 6 cubits tall, 6 in a span, grasping for more, but not quite getting it. His spear weighed 600 shekels of iron. He wore armor that looked like the scales of a dragon. And it's going to be the seed of woman, David, who is going to kill this beast with a wound to where? To his head. It's going to crush his head. Nebuchadnezzar's image in Daniel chapter 2 was 60 cubits high and 6 cubits across. I mean, the 6s just keep coming. And you can see, and I want you to turn. This is something that I just came across today. This is fresh to me and fresh to you. Go back to John 19. We've turned to John 19 several times already, but this is something I hadn't noticed before. Because the significance of this 6 plays out here in John chapter 19. Jesus here has been brought before Pilate. Who's Pilate? He's the representative of the sea beast. And Caiaphas, who is the representative of the land beast of Judaism, and he basically wrote 666 on their foreheads when he said in verse 25, "We have no king but Caesar." When did that happen? When did all of this happen? What day did it happen? On the sixth day, on Friday. At what time? Look at verse 14 of John 19. At the sixth hour. On the sixth day, at the sixth hour, we have the land beast claiming to write 666 because we are going to serve Caesar. We are not going to serve God. He's our only king. And we have Jesus there in the meantime. I couldn't believe it. I've seen sixth hour all this time, and I didn't realize the significance that might have. Now, as a side note, just to give you the other part of that, is the number 8. And 8 is the number of renewal. It's the number of covenant. It's the number of resurrection. And somebody turn to Leviticus chapter 8 and verse 33. Somebody else, Leviticus 12 and verse 3. And whoever has Leviticus 8:33, I'm going to have you read also Leviticus 9, 1 and 2. So who has Leviticus 8:33? Okay, Cindy?
"And you shall not go out of the door of the tabernacle of the congregation in 7 days."
Okay, so here's the sanctification of the priests. Sanctification of the priest is going to take place over a 7-day period. They couldn't leave. Is that the end of verse 33?
No.
Go ahead. Keep going.
"Until the days of your consecration be at an end, for 7 days shall he consecrate you."
Okay. Then go down to chapter 9 and verse 1 and 2 for the day.
"And it came to pass on the 8th day that Moses called Aaron and his sons and the elders of Israel. And he said unto Aaron, take you a young calf for a sin offering and a ram for a burnt offering without blemish, and offer them before the Lord."
Okay, so 7 days of sanctification, the eighth day they're put into office with a sacrifice. Leviticus chapter 12 and verse 3, who has that? Okay, Jonathan?
And on the eighth day, the flesh of his foreskin shall be circumcised.
Okay, and what did that do for the baby?
Part of the covenant.
Yes, they made them a part of the covenant. So the covenant was initiated with them. Jesus, when he came into town, what's that week called where he comes in between then and his death? What do we call that? It's the Passion Week. 7 days. What happens on the eighth day? He's resurrected. He's resurrected on the eighth day, on day eight. When you use this method, and look at, for instance, in Hebrew, when you take the names of Daniel, and I think they're Hebrew names, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, and you total them up because they're going to refuse to bow down to Nebuchadnezzar's image, you total up their names, it's 888. When you look at Jesus' name written in Greek, it is 888. Iota, Eta, Sigma, Omicron, Upsilon, Sigma is 888. Yes, Megan.
This is kind of going back just a little bit, but of the verse in Leviticus, so we were looking at 12:3, and I couldn't help but notice as I was looking at the page that down in verse 5, it just happens to say, it's kind of glaring to me, and then she must wait 66 days to be purified for
right.
A woman giving birth after
right.
A daughter. It just, anyways, it was like, oh,
right.
66. There
yeah,
is.
I saw that too. So thank you for bringing that up, because I don't know that I meant to bring it up, but it's good. Okay, so 8 signifies resurrection. So all in all, the number 666 would have identified not just Nero, but the Roman Empire and the Satan, the dragon who was behind it. And this is the name and the number that all who the false prophet deceived would have on their forehead and on their right hand. Again, as opposed to chapter 14 and verse 1, where the faithful have the name of God on their foreheads. I hate to do this. There are squares and triangulations. I'm going to just rip through this really quickly because I don't want to bring this up next week. The square of 6 is 36. The triangulation of 6 is 21. So there's 6 on each side. So the triangular of 36 is 666. So you've got 36 stars on every side. And the outside stars equal 105, and the 105 is 30 times 3.5, so you have 3.5 years with 12 months in each of them in 30-day increments, comes out to 1260, which is the time times in half a time, which is the time of the beast's triumph. And it's not artificial. You also have, if you look at the next one, there are 12 concentric triangles in the 666 triangulation of 36. And we talked about Matthew and the genealogy in Matthew being divided into 14. Obviously, it's artificial, but I don't think it's accidental. I think it's purposeful. Now, I want to look at this last thing. Those three Greek letters that make up 666. The first letter is chi, or he, the number for 600. And listen, when the readers would see this number written out with them, it would immediately have looked awful to them. Just the numbers themselves, the way that it looks, would have sent chills down their spines. So here's the 600. The last one, which is stigma, which is the obsolete letter, was also the first double letter. It's ST, like we have W. We still have W, though it looks like double V's when you write it. It also was the first letter in the Greek word for the cross, staros. And then in the middle, we have the word xi, which is the number for 60, which looks like a serpent and sounds like a serpent, xi. And so when they would see those letters, I mean, it would just, you've got the serpent, you've got the cross, and the first letter in the name of Christ. It just, there's conflict And you know, who knows how much more is here? You know, there may be more layers. We were talking before class. It's just like an onion. You just keep peeling it and you keep finding stuff. But this is what we came up with that. So thank you for letting me take another 2 or 3 minutes here. And let me stop.